So to start off with a compelling talk, we got a hell of a speaker over here. Sean built a critical infrastructure in 2009 for the drone program in Afghanistan. And in 2015, he began speaking about his work. And today he will tell us about the moral challenges and the need of accountability that we need in this technology that basically keeps apart the act of killing from the person that does it. And possibly, do not piss off all the agents around here, but good luck.
Hello, everybody. It's an honor to be here. I was only told recently how big of a room this was going to be, but I think I'll manage. So my talk is called The Global Assassination Grid, and I'm sure all of you kind of get the play on words there with the Global Information Grid and the NSA's program. So I'm sure I'm going to have a good show of hands, but how many people here have heard of Edward Snowden? Okay, much better than my other talks. So what Edward Snowden revealed was a global surveillance system that is pretty much spying on everybody all the time in terms of at least metadata. One of the things that catalyzed him was the drone program and actually being able to watch drone strikes on the computer from one of the offices. It's one of the things that catalyzed me as well. So what I'll be talking about today is the side of that global surveillance system that is used to assassinate people in countries that we haven't formally declared war on. So kind of to add to what he said, what I did in the Air Force is I built a system along with 70 other people that creates battlefield command and control over Afghanistan. So 240,000 square miles of it. And we're intercepting communications from not just drones, but also other fighter aircraft, A-10s, transportation aircraft. And we are creating a kind of a universal signal so that it can be transmitted long haul and sent back to places like Al Udeid and Ramstein. So that's a little bit of what I'll be talking about today. And I'll also be talking about how warfare has changed into a distributed system. This is Germany, so I will be speaking about Hannah Arendt and the Milgram experiments. I'm sure some of you are aware of those. The Milgram experiments were done to test, as a test in the trials of Alfred Eichmann, the Nazi war criminal, who was a bureaucrat, and it was to find out if a bureaucrat could essentially order the killing of all these people without feeling the human connection. The distribution and the diffusion of responsibility is something that's happened in the military for a long time, since the trebuchet. It takes five people to load up a trebuchet and get it to fire on somebody. So the question of who is ultimately responsible for that and like that kill decision is distributed among those five people. It's gotten a lot more technical, and there's a lot more going on now. But one of the things that I wanted to do, and I start off a lot of my talks with a clip from this documentary called National Bird, and that's where three other whistleblowers, besides myself, have decided to speak out, and it's a pretty good representation of what people on the ground are experiencing, as well as whistleblowers within the system. So, kind of a bit of a treat, the director is here. I didn't know that she was going to be in Hamburg, so I've asked her impromptu to come and speak here, and I didn't tell her how big the audience was either, so I'm... I apologize to her, but I'll just play this.
You literally just kind of hover, and you would wait until he walked out to the field to meet with some friends for something. You'd come up, drop a hellfire missile on him. Maybe we killed our objective, maybe we killed a guy who we thought was our objective. You don't know.
When I first got into the military, I was thinking it was a force for good in the world. I thought I was going to be on the right side of history, and today I don't believe I was.
I still have a top secret clearance, so I have to be extraordinarily cautious about what I can and can't say on camera.
My job was to watch what's happening in the video, the drones, and identify everything.
Adolescent near the rear of the SUV.
That's deceptive. You get the opinion that you're at 10,000 feet, you see this photograph. You know what's going on. You don't know what's going on. You know what you see in two dimensions.
You see someone die because you said it was okay to kill them.
It's too easy. They just emboldened commanders.
Sensors in, let the party begin.
Because there is no threat.
Oh, sweet target.
I mean, this could grow to get so out of control.
Somebody downstairs was knocking at the door, and immediately both people at the door shoved FBI badges in my face.
The Espionage Act is one of the most serious charges you can level against an American.
That I'm probably gonna get indicted and I'm probably gonna get charged.
I lost part of my humanity working in the drone program. It's a secret program. I can't just go telling the public what it is. What I can tell you is that to me, it's frightening.
And I'd like to... Now I'd like to give the floor to Sonia Kennebec. She's the director of National Bird.
Tell me what you see.
Oops.
Is this better?
Not intentional. I don't use a MacBook often.
Thank you. Wow, this is quite a surprise, Sean. Thank you very much for inviting me to this. It's really a surprise. So the reason Sean has asked me to compliment his talk a little bit is because I have been working with whistleblowers, especially national security whistleblowers, for quite a while. And during the production of the film National Bird, we teased a little bit in the trailer and talked slightly about it in the trailer. The film started out, my research started out to be research about the drone program, but it actually turned into a film about the cost of whistleblowing as well, because during the production of the film, two of the whistleblowers I had been working with, all three of them had top secret clearances and worked within the drone program, just like Sean. And so the office... of Special Investigations of the Air Force came after or tried to silence and intimidate one of the whistleblowers in my film who had been speaking out. Her name is Heather. They contacted her family during the production. I had been filming with her for over a year at that point, but a few months prior to the visit by the Air Force, she had published an op-ed on Guardian.com. And the Office for Special Investigations of the Air Force came to her family and said, you know, she is on some terror, you know, some known terrorist organization is looking for her, and you know, she should lower her social media profile and not write op-eds, and you know, just really try to scare her, which, you know, they did. And fortunately, at that point, she already had representation by whistleblower attorney Jesslyn Radack, who's also one of Edward Snowden's main legal counsels. And so Jesslyn Radack contacted the Office for Special Investigations of the Air Force, asked for more information. It turned out there wasn't an immediate threat, and it seemed to be a ruse, because they said to her, you know, there's not a problem, but they generally advise her not to, you know, not to be public, you know, not to really write anything on Facebook. And then a few weeks after that, another of my protagonists, Daniel, was raided by 30 to 50 armed FBI agents. He was told it was an investigation for espionage. So he is being investigated for espionage. And, you know, he also is now being represented by Jesslyn Radack, who represents all three whistleblowers in my film. But that is a very serious threat. And what, you know, the reason I'm telling these stories is because I think, you know, most of you here probably know, because you all are very informed, but, you know, many people in the general public are not aware of how difficult it has become to do national security reporting, and also, you know, to be a whistleblower, how much courage it takes and how much of a risk you also are taking. And, you know, under the Obama administration, more whistleblowers have been prosecuted under the Espionage Act than all previous, Obama has prosecuted more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act than all previous administrations combined since the Espionage Act was put into power in 1917. And, you know, I became a journalist because I wanted to keep, you know, politicians accountable. I think, you know, that's why it's so dangerous for our society nowadays that, you know, journalists are in a threat, because journalists and filmmakers keep our governments accountable, and we rely on whistleblowers to, you know, often rely on whistleblowers to bring the information out. So I think we have to work on both whistleblower protection and, you know, the protection of, you know, in the US, First Amendment rights and freedom of speech, freedom of the press. So I hired a First Amendment lawyer during the production, development of my film. I worked with Jesslyn Radack, and I rely on people like all of you and this, you know, technology community to support us with technology to protect ourselves. You know, I'm very thankful for tools like GPG, Tails, Signal. I think, you know, your community, and, you know, I really hope that, you know, that's my ask to you, you know, as a journalist, as a filmmaker, please go out and educate us journalists, the general public, on how to use encryption, you know, what the threats are, you know, how we can protect ourselves, because it is really essential. It's not going to, you know, go away in the future, but we all probably predict it's going to get a lot worse, especially in the United States, with the Trump administration having all of these tools, all of these, you know, data collection, data storage at the fingertips. And I, you know, really want to, you know, ask people to look at organizations like the Courage Foundation in Berlin, you know, Jesslyn Radack's organization Whisper in the US, that, you know, gives legal support and help to whistleblowers, because, you know, whistleblower protection is very important, but still, you know, there is a risk, and it takes a lot of courage. So, you know, I think, you know, we should all really give a hand to Sean Westmoreland to have the courage to speak out to you today and, you know, raise awareness for all these issues and speak truth to power. So thank you.
So I'm going to be, I guess, pretty real with you in the beginning of this talk. I What really catalyzed me, the moment that I realized that what we were doing was wrong and that I needed to at least change the trajectory of my life, was when I was in Afghanistan. And my NCOIC, which is the NCO in charge, we had built out this entire system. We had done this many times before in training and whatnot. And during the training, it was always emphasized that we're going to be saving lives. We're going to be saving U.S. troops, coalition troops, and that we aren't, you know, the other side wasn't really paid much attention to. And of course, going to Afghanistan, all of that training becomes real. And something like a technical job that you're doing to support combat troops, it's viewed as support. But when you really think about it, these support roles are often critical for the combat personnel to do their job. There's no other way around it, particularly with drones. The difference between drones and conventional aircraft is that, you know, with a A-10, it's ultimately the pilot who is sitting in the cockpit who is making the final kill decision. He's the one on the scene, and, you know, he's looking at the ground, he's there. With a drone, you have dozens of personnel, dozens of analysts, all making decisions, all looking at reality through soda straws, so to speak. Each compartmentalization, each career field, an imagery analyst is looking at the ground and picking targets based off of things that they see from the air. A signals analyst is looking at the metadata, looking at keywords that have been used in conversations with cell phones. You have translators who are looking or who are listening in on phone calls. You have geospatial analysts that are telling you which buildings are which. You have the mission intelligence coordinator that's aggregating all the information together to present a report to the commanders in Creech. And the pilot, you have the pilot that makes the final kill decision with the trigger, and the signals, or the sensor operator who is guiding in the missile. Many of you in Germany probably know who Brandon Bryan is. He has been speaking out for probably about 3 years. He's gone quiet relatively recently due to personal issues. And what he did was he guided the missile into the target, which takes about 12 to 15 seconds, depending on what the altitude is. And the pilot is the one that pulls the trigger. So within this entire system, the responsibility for the ultimate kill decision is dispersed among different individuals. So this creates like several barriers that I'll be talking about, the cognitive barriers, of course, the structural barriers, the equipment itself, and So I'll just get started on that. First off, and I know you guys are going to hate this slide, but it's I pulled it off of Wikipedia just to save my own ass. The 24th Intelligence Squadron is the culprit here that everybody in Germany is concerned about. That's the DGS. Those are the people making the analyses of the information. They direct and conduct multi-source ISR tasking, processing, exploitation, dissemination of operations in support of USAFE, EUCOM, AFRICOM, US CENTCOM, and NATO. One of interest here is US CENTCOM, and that's in charge of Afghanistan and the Middle Eastern region. And that includes a distributed ground system and also a this thing called Eagle Vision One, which is the civilian satellite counterpart. So one thing to understand is the drone itself is not the weapon system, it's just the platform. And it's a platform to deliver a payload, the Hellfire missile. And if you really want to understand drone warfare, you have to understand all of the infrastructure that's behind it and allows it to work. The DGS is pretty much like the brain of the drone. That's where all the analysts are, and they're looking at all of this information and determining whether or not that, you know, that target is a target. There's also the nerve network, which is it's the communications infrastructure, the relays, the infrastructure that I worked on in Afghanistan, and Signorella in Italy is another one, and you have various places around the US. And so I went to the German Parliament, the Bundestag, a couple of months ago, and I presented a petition stop the transmissions of communications through Ramstein. And I presented it as a violation of international law because we're in countries that nobody's formally declared war on. It hasn't been, you know, it hasn't gone through the process of the United Nations. And really, I was trying to reach out to the German population because it seems to be something that's a bit more important to them than it is to the United States. So there's more of a chance that there might be some kind of resistance. And when you have a critical piece in the puzzle like Ramstein, you know, it's a lot easier to put pressure on that than it is to put pressure on hundreds of bases all over the United States. So that was more of a it was a political gesture, but it was meant to say that, okay, we need to have some kind of accountability. If this stuff is running through the through German soil, then the German population, well, the German government is essentially complicit in whatever we're doing. So I thought it would be a good idea for the German population to basically try to challenge that, try to challenge the usage of this stuff. My biggest fear has come true. We've gone from a liberal democracy to something else that we're not really sure what that is in the United States. So Donald Trump becomes president, and he elects like all of these, you know, generals and puts them in his cabinet. And it really looks like whatever foreign policy is going to be, it's going to be heavily militarized. And, you know, drones are a very easy weapon to use. There's a very low political threshold to use them because there's no people on the ground who could potentially die, and it's very easy to hide information from populations. Another piece of what I worked on was I created this connection between the Battlefield Airborne Communications node, which is now in a Global Hawk, and it's a bridging node. It's a universal translator of sorts, a relay. It was in a Bombardier Express, an unmarked private jet, and what it allowed for was for basically a special forces operative on a cell phone to talk to somebody in the pilot of an A-10. Or it allows drones and conventional aircraft to share data and send information back to us, where we would transport it long haul through ground-based stationary satellites with higher bandwidth capacity. And the common misconception is that, the drone links to the satellite and then it goes straight down to Ramstein. But there's a lot of redundant infrastructure involved so that, say if there's signal loss or if you needed to transport higher bandwidth images, you would use RF. So we called the Bacon system the Wi-Fi in the sky. And this is a precursor to network-centric warfare. This is the beginning, where you have high-altitude relays flying over while you have hunter-killer drones flying, and ISR, information surveillance and reconnaissance, working in tandem to pick targets and eliminate them. We're not the only country that's doing this. They're working on drones in China and India. The British have them. The Israelis are really spearheading it. And even the Germans are starting to have them. And it's kind of unleashing a Pandora's box of potentials for future warfare. So BAE Systems in England, they've developed a drone called the Taranis, and they claim that it is able to pick a target, identify a target correctly, and essentially take it all the way to the point where it can make the kill decision, and then they have a human operator come in and just approve it. So it's doing this, and it's putting it into a stealth aircraft. The only reason you would need a stealth aircraft with semi-autonomous capabilities is for interstate warfare. You wouldn't need that in a place like Afghanistan. So all of this development in stealth autonomous aircraft is intended for developed nations, like Russia or China or, you name it. Those are things to be concerned about. So they are developing a higher bandwidth satellite infrastructure up there that can basically supply about 10 times more capacity than the existing infrastructure right now. And that means more drones, more imagery, and a more pervasive war. So I've identified several different issues with the infrastructure where we're using it to kill people, and so the compartmentalization of analyses and decision making I talked to you about before, where you have all of these different roles that you're using And they come together at the end to create a final report. Now, if you were to take 10 people in here and you were to give them different information, and you were to tell them, it's all information pertaining to one specific event, you were to tell them to create a picture of it and use that in determining whether or not a person lives or dies, you might find some holes in that. One problem in places like Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia is they're all pretty aware of the fact that we're listening on their cell phones and whatnot, so they're not using electronic means to communicate. They're using people like couriers and stuff like that. There's a man named Malik Jalal that I met with in the British Parliament, and he was speaking to several parliamentarians and asking them that they could remove him from the kill list, that they can ask the United States to remove him from the kill list. He kind of added to that and said that he's not really on the kill list. He's been identified as a courier, and they're using him because he is part of an organization called the Northern Waziristan Peace Coalition, and he's going around trying to de-radicalize young Taliban fighters, Pakistani Taliban fighters. You know, in most movements, I just came from Standing Rock, you have people who are grounded, and then you have people who feel like they need to defend themselves, or they need to avenge their families and whatnot. And that happens anytime you make a mistake. Now, mistakes happen a lot more often than the Obama administration is admitting. They said that there was 161 civilians killed outside of declared war zones. NGOs are reporting thousands. It's probably somewhere in between. But there isn't that external oversight of what's happening in the drone program. There's structural issues with that, to include the fact that you have some missions that are being orchestrated by the CIA. Some of them are orchestrated by the Joint Special Operations Command. One is military, one is intelligence. One is a civilian organization that's not technically supposed to kill anybody, so they are farmed out to the Air Force. That's the, like, the secret, I guess, the open secret. Then you have contracting agencies that are helping in making targeting decisions. So in any given mission, you could have three organizational overlaps within that kill decision. So if you are to trace it back and figure out where the problems lie, you have to deal with three different structures, three different organizations to parse out like what actually happened. And some of those organizations, well, they all have different security clearances. They all have different, you know, protections for whistleblowers and whatnot. So the other thing that comes into play is you have the developers who create algorithms in order to do narrow tasks. I think in 2004, there was about 300,000 hours of footage, like drone footage that was being produced. Now there's probably, you know, upwards of 2 million. There's not enough people, not enough operators to sift through all that, so you need algorithms to help you determine, you know, like, if there is suspicious patterns of activity, or if there are, you know, yeah. So the question always lies is, when you're using all of these different algorithms in tandem with people that may or may not understand what the algorithm itself actually does, is it possible that, say, you know, that the limitations of the algorithm aren't congruent with the reality you might be presented. Like, let's say you want to target anybody who is wearing a purple hat and has a tendency to pace back and forth, you know, on a street. You know, in a regular situation, you might, that might be pretty limiting. There's not many people who do that. But like, let's say Mardi Gras happens and, you know, you have, you know, this situation where you have a bunch of people wearing purple hats. That creates some confusion in that. So when you have all this technology working for you, and this is a big problem with what I find with commanders, is they get all these fancy toys. They're not necessarily up to par on, you know, like technology themselves. A lot of them may need help with using their emails. And they're sitting here looking at all this technology, and it creates this false sense of confidence, like that you have like this overarching understanding of everything that's going on. But in fact, you don't, and most people in this crowd would probably understand that. So the other issue is military training. You know, you have these operators and pilots and everybody that are going through military training. They're being broken down. They are sleep deprived, deprived of food. You get about 5 minutes to eat. You're constantly being indoctrinated with, you know, accepting the act of killing. And you're taught to fear your commanders more than you are the enemy. And those people are being put in positions where they're not going to combat. They're getting put in a box somewhere in, you know, the middle of the Midwest, and they're picking out targets. And they're doing that with the same like zeal of a Marine or whatever that is, you know, going off into Afghanistan. There's a big problem with that too, you know, and you know, there's an issue with this kind of call it confirmation bias. But you know, if you have an analyst and all he's doing is watching Fox News, and his image of, you know, all, you know, Arab people are is that, you know, they belong to this religion that is intrinsically violent, and you know, it only takes a matter of time to radicalize them. You know, they're not going to really view the population on the ground with much humanity, which is something I believe is pretty necessary when you have, you know, somebody that far away, blocked by, you know, not only distance, but also a screen that's pixelized. And, you know, an image that it may or may not be fuzzy. And a lot of cultural ignorance comes into that. You know, one instance that I'm talk about is the Kirk 97 papers that were released by the LA Times. So General Stanley McChrystal decided to release these, in part because it was very controversial, and he was also involved in the operation where it was happening. They created a kill box because there was a operation that went down earlier that day, and that particular operation ended in a strike that killed 23 civilians and 4 children. So there were 30 people in the convoy. And because of the way it looked, and because of the lack of training that the analysts got, and also the fact that it was in a kill box, which doesn't require commander approval, you can administer the strike at a lower level. You had a bunch of inexperienced people administering this strike that killed all of these innocent people. And again, that may or may not be happening at a much larger level. It hasn't been reported to the public. But in this particular incident, I like to mention the Milgram experiments. And if you don't know, there's a researcher. So the experiment goes, there was a researcher, and his job was to act as a position of authority while he's telling this volunteer to increase the intensity of an electrical shock. And he found that 60% of the time, a person was likely to obey authority and actually administer that shock. The person who was in the chair who was being shocked was an actor. So that experiment was done in front of a window and behind a window. And what they found was that while it was in front of the window, when they were sitting face to face, the person was much less likely to actually administer the lethal shock. So even a barrier of a window creates a barrier to a person's ability to feel empathy. And there was another experiment that was done where they were testing a person's visual acuity, a pilot's visual acuity while he was in a cockpit versus looking at a screen and identifying targets. They found that when they were looking at a screen, there was much more false positives that were identified with those targets. So, you know, a person's visual acuity is much better than a pixelated screen. And that extra barrier it prevents the person from feeling the reality of the fact that they're killing somebody. Another element of all of this is the acronyms that we use. Military age male is somebody who is 16 or above, and they're male. And it has gone down to about the age of 12. This is no longer a sole, indicator of a person having, militant tendencies. That was changed. But it's still one of them. And what we've done with drones, there's multiple ways to mitigate civilian casualties. You can do it in actuality, or you could do it on paper through obfuscating the language and, say, calling somebody an associated threat. In the military, we've associated proximity with guilt, and that's a huge problem when you're using weapons payloads that could have a 30-meter kill radius or 500-foot kill radius. These bombs aren't discriminate, so the narrative saying that these things are very precise is pretty easy to identify as false, because bombs are not discriminate. And if you're using it to assassinate people, it's much less discriminate than, say, using a sniper rifle. In the U.S., we've had an opposition to assassination. But what we're doing with drones is we're technically assassinating people. That creates a international norm, and essentially any country that would want to do the same thing would be able to. So if, say, Pakistan wanted to use the same argument to attack us, they would be in their right to do that. That's something else to think about. We also have words that make light of the act of killing, like when somebody has been struck and they're trying to flee the scene and they're injured, we call them squirters. when there's you know, when there's an impact and it hits the cell phone that we're targeting, we would call it a yeah, this is a few things going on there, but yeah, you know what I mean. It's a little heavy. So as far as the political side of it, of course, you know, having no soldiers dying allows countries to create narratives that this is a ethical weapon. We're saving lives of our troops, but also saving the lives of people on the ground. You know, the fact that there are civilian kills and the fact that maybe we are hitting our targets, you know, the people in those neighborhoods may or may not know that the person we're striking is an insurgent. It's not something that you would typically advertise if you were part of an Al-Qaeda network. So if it were to kill him and his family and, you know, the children, that's all those people would see. They're not getting the Western narrative of what, you know, who those people were, what they did. Most of that isn't explained. Although over there, they're much more aware of the fact that we're killing people on a consistent basis with drones than we are here. And it kind of presents another issue, the question of are these ethical tools or are they perceived as cowardice tools? You know, it's... I think it's a pretty human feeling that, you know, if somebody has a problem with you, you want them to face you, like, you know, say it to your face, to come up to you and, like, at least have the ability to talk. And, you know, you could potentially even, you know, de-escalate the situation if you had somebody on the ground. The drone is the ultimate sign of, you know, fuck you, you deserve to die. Like, there's no ands, ifs, or but it, you know, about it. So, my concerns for the future. I don't know how many people here are aware of the hacking incident with the RQ-170 Sentinel drone over Iran, where they brought down, you know, this highly sophisticated drone, and they did it by overpowering the signal. So the signal itself is a vulnerability, and having signals going back and forth are always going to be a vulnerability. So there is a incentive to make these autonomous and to have them, you know, make decisions either within the structure itself or through a mesh network. Swarming is, it appears like that's going to be the next step, particularly of, you know, countries like China. You know, they're pretty advanced with that right now. They've just developed a sort of rubber band launcher that can launch 100 of these swarming drones that are programmed to behave like swallows to surveil an area, and if it had found a target, to basically run into it. So they're, you know, loitering cruise missiles, so to speak. And that's going to be another big thing. And I don't know how many of you are aware of the stem nodes and the neural networks that they're trying to develop for prosthesis. A lot of this technology that's coming out has a dual purpose, like the military side of it. I mean, you can use it to move a hand, or you can use the imagery of the brain activity to figure out how to allow pilots to make decisions without using, you know, any of their appendages. That's the next step we need to be looking out for. Media blackouts, that goes without saying, and then miniaturization is another thing, particularly with surveillance robots. I know Black Mirror just talked about, you know, the possibilities of having little bees that will go around. I mean, it's still science fiction, but it's not science fiction in the next 25 years or less. We will have autonomous killer robots within the next 5 years. So I just hope that you're all on that, and that, you know, whistleblowers and hackers and, you know, human rights people can all work together on issues like these, and we can sort of go and take it from a multidimensional like approach. As far as solutions, of course, I met somebody in Berlin. I believe his name was Adam, and he built a, he created a clothing that is reflective infrared. So things like that, or these microwave guns that are coming out that can take out down drones, these nets that can go up and capture drones. You know, those are all iterations of you know, civilian-based approaches to possibly taking down drones with malicious intent. Like I said, I just came back from Standing Rock. North Dakota is the first state in the United States to legalize weaponized drones. They did that in 2015. And you know, that might be something that's up and coming. They're already like using excessive force against us. I have had pepper spray, CS gas, rubber bullet shot at me. And they're doing this in sub-zero weather, along with water cannons and stuff. They just blew a girl's arm off. This is happening in the United States, and it's happening where, you know, these groups aren't just indigenous people. It's also, you know, activists of different indigenous or different ethnic backgrounds. So they really don't care. And you know what really catalyzed in me while I was there is the realization that there are certain resources that are essential for life that we need to protect, and we need to be willing to put ourselves on the line and you know, put our minds to work at how to effectively protect these things, except, you know, besides just presenting a barrier to them. And something else I would be very interested in speaking to some of you with is like how we can, you know, help some of the indigenous communities lead this effort in the U.S. Right now. Transcendental solutions. That's a term that I like. You know, you have negotiated solutions that are predicated on one person getting the benefit over the other, or you have solutions that are mediated and can lead to a new reality where everybody is best served. And I'd like everybody to try and focus on those as well. And so if you have any questions, I'd be very happy to hear them.
Yeah. Sonia, grab a microphone. What a horror show. One thing I didn't get from the talk is, when will all these people be able to download your documentary?
Oh, it's actually opening in theaters in Germany, all over Germany, in May. So it will be, yeah, available in the regular theater and at some point also via download and so on. But it would be great if you come out, because, you know, we will have discussions and, you know, we will have the possibility to answer, you know, to questions at the theaters and can interact. So thank you.
First, thank you for the talk and for your work. I think you forgot one point, capitalism. All of these designs and so on have the target in mind to kill somebody. And so firing a missile is basically the success state of the GUI. So it rewards the user to do it. It's a basic design policy for GUI. And also, as a weapon producer, you want the people who are using your weapon platform to fire your missiles, because the missiles bring you money. I think this point is also to think about in the future.
Very good question, but next question, number four.
Okay. I also want to thank you. I have no idea how it must be like to actually sit there and then think about it. So thank you very much for coming forward and talking about it. I think it's very important. But I also have a question about the future, because, the drone killings are happening right now, and I believe the people there are not too happy about it. And I wonder, how can you actually mediate that? Like, how can you say, I killed your family, but, well, we can have a future where we live together? How would that even work in the future?
Right now, I'm trying to involve myself in a first approach. I'm working with an organization called Reprieve, and we're trying to, create platforms where we can have reconciliation with the victims. As individuals, not as state representatives. So I was somebody who was involved in that program. There's other whistleblowers who are working with me, Lisa and Brandon Bryant. We've all sat down with drone victims, and we've tried to have a conversation with them. Of course, that's not enough. The next stages are, it's going to be a time-consuming process. It's not something that can happen overnight. But there are people that are working on it. And this organization, Veterans for Peace, they had organized reconciliation in Vietnam. And they're going to help us with organizing reconciliation with Afghanistan, Yemen, and all of these countries as well. So, okay,
thank you.
That would be good.
One, cut it short, please.
First of all, thank you very much for your talk. I have a specific question. I want to say my position on a matter that was not really addressed, and I want to hear your opinion on that. There is an situation that is escalating right now, with the drone killings on the one side and the terrorist attacks on the other side. The word terrorist is a very strong word, and it is a very easy way for countries to legitimize using drones. And the fact that people right now are thinking that it's okay to kill civilians, but it's not okay to kill soldiers from their country, stems from the fact that they think that the civilians are terrorists. There is all this propaganda about terrorism that goes on. And this is the most important thing for me, that it legitimizes killing more and more. And on the other side, the existence of drones and attacks so much stronger than the attacks that Afghanistan or countries like that could ever possibly make, radicalize them. And the terrorists, as they are called, employ means like the attack in Berlin, and means that are really really radical, because it's the only way they can respond to threats like drones. So my point is that I would like you to tell your opinion on how to change the views on terrorism, and how to stop maybe this propaganda that was used repeatedly throughout the history to legitimize states and governments that have no other legitimization.
Yeah. No, it's okay. We need to create counter narratives. We need to create more comprehensive narratives, ones that explain how people become radicalized in the first place, and what the country has done, our countries have done historically, because you're not only dealing with religious issues, you're dealing with post-colonial issues. You know, the structures of colonialism never really went away. They're still there. I mean, the borders that are drawn all over the Middle East are borders that the British and the French established. So we need to create a civilizational narrative, one that is more encompassing just of terrorism or you know the war in the Middle East, I would say.
I'm sorry, I have to cut it off.
Didn't have to.
So, thanks.
All right.